It is time now to move to the central purpose of our evening, the Narramaration, and it is my very great pleasure to introduce the 2011 Narram Orator, Mr. William Hensley. Mr. Hensley comes to us this evening from the University of Alaska, Anchorage, where he is distinguished visiting professor in the College of Business and Public Policy. And this role recognises the extraordinary contribution he has made to his people and the community over more than half a century in public life. Furthermore, he has become an important mentor to Indigenous people throughout the world. Willie Hensley, as he is known in Alaska, was born in 1941 in a small log house along the shoreline, some 50 kilometres above the Arctic Circle. He's a native Alaskan who spent his early life with the family, travelling by dog team in winter and living in sod houses as they made their livelihood from the land and from the sea. His memoir, 50 Miles from Tomorrow, a memoir of Alaska and the real people, was published in 2008. Earlier in 1966, he drafted another significant work when he was a graduate student at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. It was titled, What Rights to Land Have the Alaskan Natives? The Primary Issue. The paper influenced the land claims movement that gained critical urgency from the discovery of rich oil fields in the Alaskan North Slopes in 1968. The land claims movement culminated in the passage by Congress of the Alaskan Native Land Claim Settlement Act, which was signed by President Richard Nixon in 1971. Willie Hensley also played a critical role in the development of the native corporations, which became an important political force, ensuring that the native Alaska community profited from national resources and other investments. Willie Hensley graduated from George Washington University in Washington, D.C. with a bachelor's degree in political science and was later elected to the Alaska House of Representatives. He was twice elected to the Alaska legislature, serving for 8 years. He also received an honorary doctorate of law degree from the University of Alaska, Anchorage. The University of Melbourne is honoured that Willie Hensley is with us this evening to present the third Narram Oration. Mr. Hensley, I welcome you to the lectern to deliver this oration titled Resilient Spirit, Alaska Native People and Our Struggle for Land, Identity and Self-Determination. Thank you.
Vunga, irrarug, kikitarug mingrunga, asin tarir me, sil suli. Anguyukatka, akpayuk, asin non karak. Kuvaisuk tunga vulpok, mani Australia meetunga. Unga sigalok, nunagik tusi, asin inuit. Paglak pagkat nga. Uvagut, nunavut, alapangro kapay. Mani, unaktok. Sikinyak apay. Chancellor Alexander, Auntie Joy, and Vice Chancellor Davis. I just wanted you to know what our language sounded like. All of our languages are under stress in Alaska. What I said was, my name is Igrearuk, and I'm named for my grandfather. And I also said I'm a Kotzebue person, which is the name of our village, named for Otto von Kotzebue, who came by there in 1815. And my parents are Non Rarak and Akpayuk, John and Priscilla Hensley. And I said I was very happy to be here in Australia. It's very distant. It is a beautiful land, and your people have welcomed me wonderfully. I said our land is cold, and here it's very hot. And I said the sun was super abundant, but not the last couple of days. I'd like to thank Murat Barak, the University of Melbourne, and Rio Tinto, Australia, for their invitation and support for the opportunity to be here. I would also like to thank Professor Anderson and Ellen Day for their contacts and direction. And I like very much your idea of inviting speakers to come from across the globe to talk about their experiences, their ideas, conditions, successes, and maybe even their failures. And that's something that I'd like to encourage us to do in Alaska, actually. There is inspiration to be gained from people around the globe who have endured difficult conditions, yet have found it within themselves to find a way to make improvements in their lives and those of their children. And Nunavut, in our language, means our land. Nuna is land. Nunavut is our land. And your indigenous world is ancient, and most likely our people emerged here and headed north over the millennia. Who knows what prompted that? Perhaps they wanted to cool off. In that case, we populated Alaska sometime in the past 20,000 years, along the way creating several distinct cultures that spread over the northern part of North America. The Inuit, the people I come from, spread over 5,000 miles from the Bering Straits across Canada to what is now Greenland. And I like to joke that if we had a couple hundred more years, we could have founded Europe. This part of the world is one of the most inhospitable parts of the globe, where cold, ice, wind, and lack of wood for heat created an extremely difficult living environment. But we thrived in spite of these physical challenges and developed the technology appropriate for that environment. We used everything imaginable to create the tools and vessels and hunting equipment to catch everything from birds, muskrats, fish, seals, and caribou to giant whales weighing 60 tons. We used the intestines of mammals for rain gear. We used the ribs of the whale to hold up our earthen homes, the skins of walrus for our sturdy but lightweight boats, bone and ivory and jade for knives and harpoon and arrowheads, but no iron unless it came down from the sky. We learned to build comfortable winter homes from snow, use the oil of seals and whales for our food and energy and light, and use dogs for transport across the polar world. We created goggles of wood and caribou hoofs to prevent snow blindness from the brilliant sun bouncing off the white expanse. The Inuit, our word for humans. In Alaska, at the time of Western contact in the mid-1700s, the Inuit, Yupik, Athabascan, Aleut, and Tlingit people composed approximately 100,000 people. The nature of the land required that we use millions of acres for our mini nations to make a livelihood, and we were spread out across the land, along the oceans and the rivers. Each language group had distinct cultures, adopting technologies as necessary from one another. This map shows the territories inhabited by our various people. Alaska, by far, is the largest state in the United States, 2.5 times the size of Texas, the second largest state, and over 550 times the size of Rhode Island, the smallest state. Alaska is slightly larger than the Northern Territory here in Australia. The Tlingit live in the southeast part of Alaska known as the Panhandle. Their land is heavily forested but temperate, with the ocean providing their main sustenance. They develop a distinct culture and unique art, as well as seagoing vessels made from huge cedar trees. The totem pole is one of their unique creations. The Athabascans live primarily in the interior part of Alaska, comprised of several language groups that are related to Canadian tribes and the Navajos in Arizona and New Mexico. The Yupik people are closely related to the Inupiat and live in southwestern Alaska along the Bering Sea, the Yukon, and Kuskokwim rivers. Today, their language is probably the healthiest indigenous language in Alaska, but all of our languages are under stress today. The Aleut live along the 1,500-mile string of islands in southwest Alaska that reach almost to Japan. They had a unique culture, their language related to that of the Inuit, and their art was extremely fine. They developed at the time of contact, their numbers were approximately 20,000. In less than a half a century, their populations plummeted to about 2,000 due to Russian wars, enslavement, and disease. The culprit for the arrival of this catastrophe was the sea otter, a fine fur valuable in China and Russia for the upper classes to keep warm. The Russian fur hunter stage that began when survivors of the Bering expedition made it back to Kamchatka after sighting Alaska. Unfortunately, they brought back 600 sea otter and fox pelts. That started a stream of hunting expeditions that resulted in Alaska natives ultimately losing control of our homeland. There was enslavement, killing, and disease as the Russians tightened their grip from the Aleutians to Kodiak Island and then to Sitka in southeastern Alaska. They even established a colony in what is now California and made an effort to establish one in Hawaii. Oddly enough, the Russian never had more than 800 of their own kind in Alaska at any one time, but they had the guns. Rather than lose Alaska to foreign competitors and after they had almost killed off all the sea otters, the Russians opted to sell their interest in Alaska to the less than 80-year-old country of the United States for $7.2 million in 1867. Now, the United States took over administration of Alaska but did not provide any democratic institutions until 1884, when they passed the Organic Act to establish a legislature, a court system, and provide a means for miners to secure claims for their discoveries. Between 1867 and 1924, Alaska Natives were not citizens of the United States and had no protection for their land or civil rights. There was no right to vote. But in the meantime, American fishing interests began building canning facilities along all the major rivers and began to take the fish that provided sustenance to Native people. Whaling ships began to take the large bowhead whales that the Inuit depended on for their livelihood. And miners began to find gold in our lands, and the rush was on. We began to become a minority in our own homeland with no protection for any of our indigenous land rights. Finally, in 1924, the United States passed a law providing citizenship for American Indians and Alaska Natives. But in Alaska, in the territory, the no dogs or natives allowed continued until the 1940s, when they passed an anti-discrimination bill in 1945. We Alaska Natives inherited the legal, administrative, and political history that began with American Indians in the early history of the United States. The treaties with the tribes were contracts that were enshrined in the U.S. Constitution, and Supreme Court cases began to lay out the framework of relationship between the tribes and the federal government. The tribes were independent governments operating independently but overseen by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The land in the reservations was held in trust for the Indians by the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Over time, programs of all kinds were authorized in education, health, economic development, public safety, and others. The American Indians' land was taken, and only 50 million acres is held by them in trust today. Land that was taken illegally over time was compensated for in payments of a few cents an acre through the federal court system or through the Indian Claims Commission that was established in the 1940s. Now, coming to Alaska, the Treaty of Cession between Russia and the United States was never supported or approved by the native people of Alaska. The Russians could not have had sovereignty over all of Alaska with only 800 Russians in the territory. Fortunately, our country did develop law that recognized Aboriginal title or Indian title. And that notion had substance in our legal and political system. While we were not permitted to lease or sell the land, the taking of it could be compensable. The major clash came when settlers decided to become a state and convinced Congress to pass the Statehood Act in 1959. That law would allow for the new state to select over 100 million acres of land, of our land, to help the state economically survive. At the absolute 11th hour in 1966, we found our voice and began to protest the state selections, began to claim our traditional lands, and found a Secretary of Interior, a member of the cabinet, Stuart Udall, who was willing to side with Alaska Natives and froze all disposition of lands in Alaska until the issue was resolved. We organized the Alaska Federation of Natives to pursue the settlement. It consisted of all the major tribes, the Inuit, the Yupik, the Athabaskan, the Aleut, and the Tlingit. Finally, in December of 1971, with the unlikely ally, Republican President Richard M. Nixon, the democratically controlled Congress passed the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act, providing 44 million acres of land and almost $1 billion to Alaska Natives. While that amount of land is only a fraction of what we traditionally controlled, it is unprecedented in United States Native American history. Alaska Natives own almost as much land as all the Native Americans combined. There are 2 million of them and only 130,000 of us. What is unique and still controversial in some quarters is the fact that Congress provided corporations as the administrative vehicle of the land and the money. Corporations that are owned and controlled by Alaska Natives. Congress opted to take the Bureau of Indian Affairs out of the picture and put the future of Alaska Native lands and capital in the hands of the Native people. That was a major shift in United States policy dealing with Native Americans. Not content to cry over the fact that we lost so much land, and knowing that U.S. history is mighty grim for American Indians, we decided to make the best of a bad situation and began to learn to operate in the wild and woolly world of capitalism. The Act created 12 regional corporations and 175 village corporations owned and controlled by Native people. To bring it down to earth, the regional corporation I belonged to and once headed received about $50 million as our share and about 2.2 million acres of land. 40 years later, Nana owns what was at one time the world's largest zinc and lead mine, and many businesses, and our revenues are in the $1.5 billion range with about 15,000 employees. Nana is owned by 12,000 Inuit shareholders. And last year, approximately 1,400 of our shareholders were employed and brought home about $50 million in earnings. And when we started, none of us knew anything about business. We were basically subsistence hunters and fishermen and trappers and were simply consumers without any capital. So in my lifetime, we have moved from living in tents and earthen homes, traveling by dog team and kayak to operating a company that's doing business in many parts of the world. And our people took a risk in that settlement, but we decided that using the common sense that our people had, we began to put together the corporation, started selecting the land to make sure that we had a combination of important cultural lands as well as lands that had some economic potential, and selected the staff and began to learn the intricacies of running a corporation. In the meantime, our original entity was a nonprofit that I precipitated the organizing of in the mid-60s. It's now called Manilak. And in our language, Manilak means without money, nonprofit. But we also had a prophet by the name of Manilak back in the 1800s who actually predicted several things that came through, including wireless communication, the internal combustion engine, and also helped break some taboos that made our life difficult. We could not eat mammal food and land food at the same time at one time in our history. And he got rid of that taboo. Manilak, the nonprofit that we started, a predecessor to the regional for-profit corporation, is the manager for 10 tribes in our region, and they operate social service programs of a whole variety. And it employs about 550 people as a major employer in the region. Now, Inupiat Ilitkuset. I hear that Marap maybe means spirit. Well, oddly enough, Inupiat Ilitkuset has a similar meaning. Since the 1740s, Alaska Natives had suffered this violent encounter with the Russians. And the very basis of our existence in the whales and fish were being taken by others. We also began to lose control of our traditional ancient spaces. And we had a combination of government and religious societies began to make war on our languages, our music, our dance, our ceremonies, our potlatches, and our art. They began to take our children away to boarding schools at a young age. So we were losing them physically, linguistically, and spiritually. I know this sounds familiar. I myself attended high school 5,000 miles away from home and returned only once in 4 years. All of this change and pressure has consequences in terms of social cohesion, one's sense of belonging, values, and self-worth. One begins to become a stranger in his own land, and the school system brings in a program that has no room for one's own culture and world. A sense of isolation creeps in as you lose your grip on your old world and are no longer able to communicate with parents and grandparents and other loved ones who used to make up your entire world. And on top of that, the pressures of new institutions, not of our own making, new regulations over our former lands, changing technologies, all work to deaden one's spirit. Without spirit, a person's inner world begins to die, and all the corporate and political activity does not take the place of the spirit of one's own people and culture. It was a cold winter night in Nome in 1980 when it became obvious to me that all of us had been pummeled and pressured and repressed in almost every aspect of our lives, and it had been going on for several generations. It was so enveloping that I didn't even know that I was in an invisible cauldron of stress and had been so since I was a little boy. I'd been trying to meet the expectations of my teachers and the pastors and the Bureau of Indian Affairs officials, all of whom had nothing good to say about our language, our history, our culture, our music, our food, our values, our art, survival skills, or spiritual life. And for several generations, our parents and grandparents had tried to change because they thought their children would have a better and easier life. They did not seem to understand that our human connections were being severed and our memories were being torn asunder as we tried to absorb a new language and a way of life that took us further and further from home. In some cases, we began to deny our own identity, especially in the days of outright prejudice and discrimination. Oddly enough, it was as a corporate official of NANA that I called a meeting of our leaders one winter night, at the senior center, a place we had built for our elders, the carriers of tradition and knowledge It was there that we began to see that it was not enough to elevate ourselves economically and to provide for better housing and safe water and good schools. If we were going to continue as a special part of the human race, we had to regenerate our human spirit, our identity, and the values that had sustained our people over millennia. That night, we identified the essence of our people in what might be described as the Inuit Ten Commandments, those values that had enabled us to be human in a cold and dangerous world. We understood that our values of sharing, cooperation, humility, loving our children, respecting our elders, knowing our family tree, and working hard are all values that were relevant today as well as 10,000 years ago and relevant for the future. Furthermore, they identified you as an Inupiat, a real person, someone with a sense of responsibility and proper behavior who would do his or her duty among our own people as well as elsewhere. 50 years ago, our average age of death was 45, and our infant mortality was extremely high. We worked very hard to provide safe water and sanitation for our 200 villages, schools, housing, airports, and health centers. We have sent hundreds of our students to universities and put thousands of our people to work. So we've tried in every which way to elevate the material life of our people. One of the ways we've done that, which I think is quite unique, is that our people live along the shores of the oceans and the bays, along the rivers, the lagoons and inlets. Marine life has permitted our people to survive. The mammals, crustaceans, and fish of the sea have been our bread and butter since time immemorial. As a consequence, a unique program approved by our federal government and monitored by the state is called the Community Development Quota Program, CDQs. In recognition of our village dependence on the ocean resources and the limited economic opportunities, the government allocated a percentage of the pollock, crab, halibut, and other species to coalitions of villages along the western coast of Alaska. There are six of these coalitions, comprising 65 villages, that can either take their percentage and market it to seafood companies, or they can purchase ships and processing facilities and handle the allocation themselves. These independent village fisheries associations have now operated for 20 years, and the volume of business has grown tremendously as they have learned to operate in the industry. They've created employment opportunities, attracted capital, built infrastructure, and improved social and economic conditions, as well as provided education and training opportunities for their fellow villagers. Their total assets are now in the $500 million range, employing over 3,500 with aggregate salaries of about $25 million. Their net profits in 2007 was over $40 million. The significance of this activity is underscored by the fact that living costs are so expensive. A gallon of milk costs $11 in some villages, and a gallon of gasoline reaches $10 in some villages. So the creation of this program was an outgrowth of our land claims experience and our belief that despite a lack of education and experience, we believe that our people could take on new challenges to use the common sense our ancestors used to create a world in harsh conditions, make decisions on both personnel and technical issues for the benefit of the people. Now, there's always a challenge around the corner, and nothing stays the same. And for the future, our challenge is twofold. Alaska's financial underpinning has been based on oil production and federal spending. Our throughput peaked at 2 million barrels in 1988. We are now down to 600,000 barrels per day and decreasing about 7% a year. Alaska's population has increased by 500,000 since the beginning of statehood. And without an income tax, 90% of our annual budget comes from oil revenues. Both urban Alaska and village Alaska will have serious financial issues within 10 years, in my opinion, unless some great good fortune befalls us. And so far, there's nothing in sight that will pay the bills of our financial superstructure that we have built up over the past 40 years. Someone always has to pay the bills, and for us it has been oil and the federal government. With Washington tightening its belt, we'll begin to feel it as our revenues declined, and that is the big rub. In my lifetime, our people were masters of their own lives. A difficult life, but one that was understood, that we understood, and we interacted with the natural universe. It was a hard life, but a good life, if you had your health. Many of our people have become dependent on an economy that may diminish faster than we are prepared to recognize and prepare for. Our tribes and our corporations have done wonders to elevate our material lives, but Alaska is a stern taskmaster. It is remote, high cost, distant from the markets, and not exactly a breadbasket. We have issues of alcoholism and drugs, a high percentage of inmates in the prisons, and a high suicide rate in spite of all of our progress. The good news is that our people are resilient. We have dealt with massive changes that have occurred in our world, a new state, new technologies, new institutions, a wave of new residents from the lower 48, and many new regulations that make our hunting and fishing livelihood more difficult. We believe that there's nothing that can be as challenging as those days when our people had to survive with tools of stone and bone, as they met polar bears, walrus, the whales with their own human strength to feed their families, who withstood the 40 or 50 below zero temperatures and the fierce winds, yet faced life with joy and celebration when they danced and sang our ancient songs. Here in Australia, you have faced your challenges and will continue to do so, just as we have in the Arctic. That's the nature of life. There will always be the powerful and the powerless, the majority and the minority. And there will always be a nation with power over your lives. Your nation and our nation both descended from a country that has evolved from the days of the Magna Carta. And there is an element of social responsibility and equity in that history. And my dream is that you will continue to work to improve the lives of the Indigenous people of Australia, as we have done in Alaska. From my experience, the responsibility of leaders is to provide hope. And from what I have seen in my short stay is that many of you are or will be the leaders who will help shape the future for Aboriginal people in this nation. My dream is that all Australians will come together to fashion a world that provides hope and opportunity for the people who made a life in this land long before the Europeans came along. Your children and grandchildren are depending on you. Kuyana, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here and visit with you.